for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. John Prendergast and Michael Mattox grew up in completely different worlds, but each of them was deeply scarred by childhood circumstances. A chance encounter brought them together, and now they've co-written a book about how their 25-year friendship profoundly affected their lives. The book is titled Unlikely Brothers. John Prendergast and Michael Mattox join me in the studio. I hope you'll join us as well. It's wonderful to have some good stories, and we don't get them often enough. Join us by phone, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Thank you for having us.
Lovely to have you here. Really good. Michael, tell me about your first memory of John Prendergast.
Well, my first memory of John, it was a wonderful one when I first seen him. You know,
where were you?
We lived in the shelter.
You lived in the shelter?
Yes.
And how did John happen to come in?
Well, we was at the shelter on certain Saturdays. We were go to his buddy room, and he would let us get changed. And one day, John just walk up. Me and my brother was up there getting changed out of the little chair, and we see John. We really didn't pay no attention to him at first, and then he asked his buddy who we were. He introduced us to him, and we, from that day forward, we just been brothers, you know. And I mean, it was amazing, you know, because once he seen us, he took a liking to us. I just see the spark in his eyes that he had for us. And he just became our big brother.
Did you have the same spark in your eyes for him? Maybe not so quickly.
Not so quickly.
Yeah.
Not so quickly, but at that moment, I knew, because he asked me and my brother, did we know how to read? And we told him a little bit. Started taking us to the library, teaching us how to read, and went from there. Been known for 25 years.
John Prendergast, why? What was it that happened in you that day?
Well, that was a funny part about writing this book. You know, my initial answer to that maybe 2 years ago would have been, well, because of course I'm such a great guy. But then, as the process of starting to write this book, and you really have to, in any kind of a memoir, in our case, it's a dual memoir, you know, you have to examine your motivations. Like, why did you really do this stuff? And I realized that there were huge holes in my life at that time. And I was very, very, I was a sad person, depressed person. And I was looking to fill it with things, with external things. You know, I was fighting for justice in the neighborhoods of Washington, D.C. And Michael and James is Michael's little brother, were just two sort of manifestations of that. If I could somehow work with them and help them, maybe I could help the bigger issues. But really, I was trying somehow to find meaning for myself in my own life, looking back on it. I mean, I sure didn't think that then, but I now understand it to have been a big...
And clearly something happened that very day.
Yeah, they really broke through the sort of crusader that I fashioned myself to be at that very young age of 20. You know, Michael and James were right in front of me, and there were just these extraordinary, joyful kids in the midst of a very terrible circumstance, that they were living out of hefty plastic bags in a homeless shelter, going from shelter to shelter, 1 week to the next. And it was a very, very difficult experience. And yet they were, I don't think I ever had as much fun when I would hang around with those guys. They were just full of joy. So it really, it impacted me on a human level. I was estranged from my father, and I didn't really have a close family connection at that time. I was sort of a satellite without a mothership, you know? So, and here is the new family in effect. And I sort of cotton to these guys in a way that I just, you know, hadn't imagined that kind of a relationship had any room in my life.
Michael, tell me about what your life was like back then.
My life back then, it had its bad moments and it also had its good moments. But, you know, being at that young age where, you know, we was homeless and that was like a hurtful situation. You know, when we met John, it like kind of, he took a lot of that away, you know, because he did things with us. You know, it wasn't just all about us being in that shelter. He made sure we had fun and he was young himself. You know, so he made sure we had a lot of fun when we were small.
Where was your mother and how was she taking care of you and your four siblings?
Well, my mom was young. You know, she was around, but at the same time, it was stressful for her, too. You know, being young, we bouncing from shelter to shelter.
She was scraping by.
Yes, she was. You know, I mean, it was kind of rough, really rough for her.
What kinds of meals could she provide for you?
Whatever, you know, basically she could. Really, sometimes it wasn't really nothing. You know, we ate cereal here and there. Whatever was there to eat and whatever she could get to eat for us. You know, some days we wouldn't eat but the cereal, you know. So it was, you know, rough situation. It's painful. It's painful.
You know? Describe on the first page of this book seeing your mother and other relatives crying because of what happened to your aunt. What happened?
Well, when I was younger, my aunt, you know, her husband had beaten her to death. And killed her, and he basically wrapped her body in the plastic and stuffed her body in a wall and basically made her kids help him do that. And plastered the wall back over, painted back over, and, you know, my aunt, she was missing. So when they went back in there to the apartment, they smelt actually the body. They smelt it. They just didn't see it, but it was there. And they noticed that one particular spot, that's where her body was at, and broke the wall and I guess got her body out of there.
Was your uncle taken to jail?
Yes. I think he had got 25 to life. Yeah, which he did his 25, and I think he's home now.
He's home now?
Yes, I think so.
Tell us about Willie.
Oh, yeah, Willie was a great guy. You know, we wasn't his kids, but, you know, we didn't never see, you know, any signs that we wasn't his kids because he took care of us. And, you know, he didn't show no favoritism because, you know, James was basically only his son. And he made us all feel like we was his kids. So, you know, I always thought, you know, that was my dad. And he was a great guy. He really was. He took us fishing when we were smaller, too. He did things. We went up New Jersey with him, and too, you know, he took real sick real bad. You know,
he took sick real bad.
Yes.
He died.
Yes, he died. He died.
He took sick, as I recall, and spent 6 months.
Yes.
Away from home.
Yes, he did.
And then when he came back, he didn't know anything.
No, that was a hurtful situation. Hurtful. Because, you know, he went from this guy that knew us and loved us from this guy that didn't even know us no more. He would blink in and out knowing us and then he don't know us. You know, that was kinda, you know, we were small, but at the same token it was painful and it was hurting.
Michael Mattox, he's a former drug dealer.
Yes.
He lived in a homeless shelter as a child. He's now a husband and father who works as a shuttle bus driver. John Prendergast is a human rights activist, co-founder of the Enough Project to in crimes against humanity. He's a former Clinton administration advisor, and together they have written a new book titled Unlikely Brothers, Our Story of Adventure, Loss, and Redemption. And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. John, your childhood wasn't so great either.
Yeah, I had really what I would consider an idyllic one up until perhaps the age of 7 or 8. My dad was a real Pied Piper. This is one of these guys that's just a giant of a man, an Irish Catholic storyteller from Pittsburgh. And he just, every neighborhood we moved a lot. Every neighborhood we lived in, you know, the kids would come knocking on the door. When can Mr. P come out and play, you know? And, but as soon as I would begin to assert my own individuality, independence, you know, again, looking back, I didn't understand at the time. He was a Korean War sergeant and had very difficult childhood of his own in terms of this father just coming down on him like a ton of bricks. So he just couldn't accept any kind of deviation from his way or the highway. And so it became very, very hard. He was very abusive, and it became a hard situation for me.
John Prendergast and Michael Mattox, and the book is titled Unlikely Brothers. We'll take just a short break. When we come back, more of our conversation and your calls. And if you've just joined us, we're talking about a new book. It's titled Unlikely Brothers, Our Story of Adventure, Loss, and Redemption, written by two people years apart, experiences apart, racial divide, but they came together and have been dearest friends for 25 years. John Prendergast and Michael Mattox. And if you'd like to join us, questions, comments on the phone, email, on Facebook, or Twitter. Michael, did you ever meet your father?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, the day I met my real dad, my mom had a party. We was living on the Southeast, and one of my aunts brought my dad over there. And that day she brought my real dad over there. And when he walked through the door, I always thought Willie was my dad. But when my real dad walked through the door, I knew that was my dad.
You knew it.
I knew that was my
How'd
dad.
How'd you know?
The feeling I got in the way he looked.
Gut feeling.
Yes. And I was a little boy, and I looked it just like him.
How old were you?
I think I was probably 9.
Okay.
And it was wild because I was young, but I knew that was my dad at the same time. And I was like, oh, and it hurt me so bad. It really did. I was so hurt because Willie, that's who I knew as my real dad was. But when I found out that that was really my really, really dad, it hurted me. It crushed me as a little boy. But I still consider Willie as my dad because that's who I knew who took care of us.
Why did, why do you think your aunt brought your dad to your home?
I think he wanted to see us. I really do.
Did you have any contact with him afterwards?
Well, yeah, he came around for a little while, but he left back out again.
Yeah.
You know, he left back out again.
Was your mother happy to see him?
Yeah and no. You know, my mama was happy to see him, but she, you know, asked mom, why did she bring him around?
Yeah.
You know, but it was too late. He was there. And, you know, he stayed around for a while. I guess they got back together for a little while, and he left right back out.
That's tough.
Yes.
Seeing people come and go that way.
Yes.
But your dad stayed, John, and you as... I gather the oldest of your siblings, he took it out on you.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think so many boys, you know, growing up have this experience where, you know, you just, I mean, mine was certainly the sort of prototypical. He just, there was just, it was volatile and constantly screaming matches. And then we went silent. And we basically didn't speak to each other for 20 years.
What about your mother? How did she react?
Always trying to, you know, trying to bring us back together. I mean, she worked very, very hard praying. I mean, she probably prayed more than any mother woman I know for her son and her husband to reconcile. And it took us 20 years. But over time, we began to re-thaw the relationship, but those years of sort of adolescence were very, very painful.
How'd you deal with his rage?
I sort of, in two ways. Inside the house, I just built a big turtle shell and just stayed inside it all the time. I used to go down in the basement whenever I was home and just stay in the basement wherever we would live. I had my little hiding places and I'd go there. But outside, I think I became more and more assertive, you know, very combative. Because I was always I'm a combative personality to begin with, and certainly that probably was part of the seeds of the problems that we had in the first place, my dad and I. But I think that it became sort of a dominant trait as I grew older. It was just somebody who was always fighting for something, you know.
And then you began bringing Michael and his siblings to your house.
It was in some ways awesome and probably was the seed for eventual reconciliation with my dad because he lit up like a Christmas tree when Michael and James and the other and some of his other siblings used to come and stay. And he, you know, he had his chance to be
Once
dad
again.
All over again.
Yeah,
and he was
Mr.
phenomenal.
P, yeah.
I mean, there is simply no one I've ever met that dealt with kids like him. And so we had these incredible adventures, mostly him taking the kids off and me going off and working somewhere because I was always sort of on the edge of minimum wage. And I certainly, even though I wasn't speaking to him, I certainly admired and was so grateful for the model that he was providing to these young guys.
What was it like for you, Michael, to be in that house, to sit down, to have dinner, to talk? You know, what was that experience like for you?
It was amazing. It was like an experience we never had before. You know, Mr. P and Mrs. P, they was really, really awesome. You know, Mr. P, he loved us to death. He really did. We had so much fun with Mr. P and Mrs. P. But Mr. P, he was, you could see the child in him come out. You know what I'm saying? He was like, pack us in a station wagon. This was this little hill he used to always like to jump over in a station wagon. And we do it again, Mr. P, do it again. He turned the station wagon back around and do it again. I mean, it was wonderful. You know, and we all sit around at the table and, you know, we eat dinner as like a family. And it was amazing. It really was.
How was it then to go back to your own home?
Just the to go from like that good life, you know, for that weekend, and then got to go back. You know, it was
go back to
our own house. It was like, oh man.
Did your mom have a house by then?
Well, when we first went to Philly, we was in a shelter. When we first went to Philly, we was. So when we did go back, we had to go back to the shelter. And that was like, I want to stay up Philly with Mr. P and Mrs. P. That's where it's good at. You know, we had to go back to that shelter, and, you know, it wasn't good at all.
Tell me why and how you turned toward the streets and drug dealing.
Well, it came a time in my life, you know, I was young, and, you know, we got teased a lot when we were small, you know, younger. And
because?
You know, the stuff we wore, you know, we got teased a lot. And I basically, we started seeing the drug dealers on the street, you know, with the gold and dressing good. And I'm like, I want to be like that. You know, I want to, that's what I want. I want that look. And you see the power they got. I want that power, you know. And I'm a young boy.
How old are you at this point?
I was probably just turned 11 years old. Mm. But John was still coming to get us, you know. And I was still going with him at that time. But at the same token, that's when it all started kind of, you know, turning around, and I started like watching more of the drug dealers, how they do this and how they do that. But I was still going with John, and turned 12 years old, and it started dying down a little bit. 13, that's when it all, you know, I ain't want to do the John thing no more. I was like out there on the streets.
How'd you get started?
Hanging with a little group of guys, you know. And then I was hanging around an older gentleman, you know, got started with him. And, I mean, just went from there and just became a drug dealer.
Selling them on the street.
Yes, selling it on the street.
And where, John, were you at this point?
Well, just a year after I first met Michael, I had my sort of career transformation when I was sitting in a chair one day and watched this little advertisement for one of the humanitarian organizations, and they showed all this footage of the Ethiopian famine. This is 1984. It's a height of the famine. 1 million people eventually died in that famine in Ethiopia. And it just hit me at such a deep level that people could suffer this extremely, this in this order of magnitude, and I just felt compelled that I had to go. And so I ended up going to Africa, and it forever altered my own destiny, that trip. And I came back and basically switched career paths away from my sort of crusading for local justice and economic justice and to the global. But it was really Africa and conflict in Africa.
How'd you get the money the first time you went to Africa?
Begging and borrowing and just a little stealing. I think my parents chipped a little bit in, even though they were extremely reluctant and skeptical, and then other relatives. And I had saved for my landscaping jobs and other kinds of things. So I just said, you know what, I'm going to go all in and get a one-way ticket and go. And just roll the dice and see what happens.
And you knew you were leaving Michael and others behind.
I think there was a lot of self-delusion. I think that I felt, you know, I can do both, no problem. And, you know, I felt like I'll just come back. I'll just pick it right up, no problem. Nobody will worry about me being gone for a bit. And, you know, because I wanted to believe that instead of, you know, facing the truth, which is you're making a choice and there's going to be some severe consequences.
How old was Michael when you left?
8.
How'd you feel about his leaving?
Well, at that time, we really didn't know that he was, like, gone to, like, Africa. I thought we wasn't going to see him no more. But he popped back up. Months later, he popped back up, and we were excited to see him. You know, we were real excited to see him. And I just wish he wasn't gone, like, too long like that, you know?
And apparently over the years, you really wanted to pull John aside and tell him that you had gotten involved in drugs, but you were afraid to tell him.
Yes, I was. I didn't want, you know, I think I was worried about him criticizing me, and I thought maybe, you know, he probably would turn his back on me or didn't want to talk to me no more, and I didn't want that, so I just would act like I wasn't into the life thing.
But at the same time, probably deep inside, maybe you were waiting for him to say,
yes,
to you, get out of this.
Yes, yes, yes.
Did you have any idea, John?
You know, again, the self-delusion. You know, his mother, when I would come by, because they eventually moved out of the shelter into these little subsidized apartments, different places, once in Southeast D.C., then up to North Capitol Street, and then all the way up to Georgia Avenue. And each place, you know, she would be telling me, you know, this is what's going on. There's all this stuff. But Michael looked like Michael. I would talk to him. I would say, like, what's going on, buddy? And he'd be like, nothing. I don't know what she's talking about. She, you know, she's just crazy. And so, you know, I didn't have any time. You know, I was working so much. I was, like, obsessed with trying to build my little fledgling career. I was going over to Africa all the time. So when I would come back to the United States, I would only have a short time before I was going back again. So I'd be in such a hurry. So I'd have all these ideas. Okay, I'll go to Michael's school. I'll talk to the people there. I'll go to the social work. I'll talk to them there. I'll work with him on these things. And then they would just crumble in the face of all these competing priorities. And I just let him down one time after another.
John Prendergast and Michael Mattox, their new book, written together, is titled Unlikely Brothers. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Michael, what was going on in your life when you were dealing drugs?
It was a lot going on, a lot, you know. It was painful. It was painful, you know. I mean, I hurt a lot of people.
Who'd you hurt?
You know, like, you know, my mom, she was, like, really hurt by the situation because, you know, I was out of control and wasn't nothing she could do about it, and I was young. Nothing.
And you were using drugs as well.
Yes, I was using drugs. I was drinking. You know, carrying a gun. You know, I was, you know, and young. I was out there doing grown man things, you know.
And you lost your best friend, didn't you?
Oh, yes, I lost my best friend.
How?
He got shot in the face with a .45.
You saw that happen?
I saw it, yes, I did. Hurt me so bad. And that's why the drinking, you know, came along, because I couldn't sleep. I would have nightmares, and the only way to get away from that pain, I would drink myself to sleep. I would drink, I mean, so much liquor and just pass out. And that was the only way that I could sleep, if I drink. And I started drinking so heavily. You know, I started drinking heavily.
What about your brothers, James and Tyrell?
Oh, yeah, that was like, that right there, when that happened too, that like,
what happened?
You know, my brother James got shot in the stomach, you know.
He died?
Yes. Hurt me so bad. I just left my brother 30 minutes before he got shot.
Tyrell?
Yeah. Tyrell, he hung himself, you know.
Because?
Well, really don't even know, for real. I really don't. I mean, it's... you know, sad, you know, I think about them every day, and I think, you know, about what happened, and it hurts every day. It really do. I think about my brothers every single day.
Were they also involved in drugs?
My brother James was, but he had straightened his life up. He became a plumber. You know, he just wasn't that mean boy no more. He straighten up. The last words he said to me before I left him was, I see you in church tomorrow. But that night, he got shot in the stomach and died. You know, he turned his life around. He was turning his life around. He was a plumber, taking care of his family.
And what did it take to turn your life around?
My kids. I love my kids. I do.
How many?
I got 5 boys.
You have 5 boys?
Yeah.
But you didn't then.
No. I didn't stop then, but it just, you know, things happen, you know, and I was tired, and, you know, I knew at a point in time that it was going to have 2 choices, was jail or death, and I didn't want either one.
Michael Mattox, John Prendergast. Short break, right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Visa, whose Visa Signature credit card offers access to the movies this summer. Details at fandango.com/Visa Signature. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by Novo Nordisk, since 1923, committed to diabetes care and areas of unmet medical needs, at novonordisk-us.com. This is NPR.
You know the global competition and conflict surrounding oil? Lester Brown says that's starting to happen with food. He'll explain why on the next Fresh Air. Brown's article, The New Geopolitics of Food, is published in Foreign Policy magazine. Also, Michael Spector will discuss his New Yorker article, Test Tube Burgers, about scientists trying to grow meat in labs. Join us.
I'm sure there is a great deal that each of you, John Prendergast and Michael Mattox, have learned about each other in writing this wonderful book, Unlikely Brothers. One thing that we haven't talked about, John, is the acne you had as a young man, which really affected your outlook on life.
It's really interesting. You know, at the very moment that my father's and my relationship blew up, you know, just exploded, my face similarly exploded in these lesions, and it's very difficult because you hide, you know, because you're just so horrified by how you look, and you think that everyone is watching you think that everyone is commenting and laughing. And how that affects, I mean, there are so many things that affect our psyches as we grow up, as we're kids and get older. And I think this is one of those things where if you're even temporarily disfigured, it has a profound impact. Mm. And so I just closed off in many ways and just became, again, very combative with my father at home, with the face and with all these other issues that any kid faces. But we were moving constantly. You know, the self-protection, the walls just kept getting built up.
Of course. And Michael, that was something you learned about John. You had no idea that was such a problem.
No idea at all. No, we never, like, you know, we seen it, but you know, we didn't judge him on that, or we didn't know it was a big problem, like, with his face.
By that time, we found Accutane.
Yes. Yeah. Here's an email from Montague, Michigan, or Montague, Michigan. It's from Chris, who says, given the racial and class divides that separate us in many communities, what do you think ordinary citizens can do to bridge this divide? John?
Well, I think that one of the things that we are very interested in promoting, in effect, from our lives, in our experience, is this extraordinary opportunity that every single human being has to mentor someone younger. Whether it's joining formally into something like the Big Brother, Big Sisters program, or something less formal like a tutor at a school or a mentor. There's so many different programs you can do through your community and your church. And, you know, if I look back on it, frankly, the biggest lesson I learned from looking back and at this part of my life, the part with Michael, you know, I was not the best big brother. I abandoned him often. I wasn't there for him in his most important moments, his moments of biggest need. But I sort of hung around. And the fact that I was around, he thinks, was one of the reasons why he was able to make it through the hardest and darkest period of his life and be able to merge on the other side to be a great father and a great husband. So just the idea that even someone as flawed as my mentorship of Michael could have that kind of impact, we hope it inspires people to say, you know what, I can do something too.
Did you ever get angry with John, Michael?
No, I never got angry with John at all. But I, you know, he worked a lot. And I think them times when I started, like, veering off to the right, you know, to the other side, if he was around, like, constantly, I probably wouldn't have veered off that way, you know, because he was
into
constantly.
Into the drug world.
Exactly. If he was around more, you know, like, I probably wouldn't have went to that side. You know, sometimes John would leave. He wouldn't see him for 2, 3, 4 months. He'd come back around. And at that time, in 4 months, you know, there's a lot that could be done in
you
4 months.
You bet.
You know, I'm ran off, and he'd come around, and, you know, I get snatched back a little bit. But, you know, it's, you know, more and more. So if he was around, like, constantly.
That would have helped.
Yeah, it would have helped.
Let's open the phones. Let's go to Jay in Greenville, North Carolina. Good morning to you.
Good morning. My question is for John. Since the organized authority engenders and perpetuates a lot of the injustices that you seem to work against so ardently, how did your experiences within the most powerful of these halls, how did it inform your real-world efforts as a humanitarian? Furthermore, how do you remain positive knowing this? Thank you.
Well, thanks, Jay. I mean, I feel like, again, hindsight is a great aid to vision. But what I've been fortunate enough to be part of over my lifetime is a series of things that maybe at the time didn't seem like they were worthwhile. Marching in front of the South African embassy during the anti-apartheid movement, standing in front of jewelry stores, talking about something that nobody heard of called blood diamonds in the late 1990s, or spending all these years with Michael. You know, these are all examples of things that often I felt were time that, at the time, like, wow, are we really going to make a difference? Well, South Africa is a majority rule democracy today. As we all know, the great story of the anti-apartheid movement and the influence it had. Nelson Mandela, who I worked with very closely when I worked for President Clinton, said there wouldn't have been a transition as it happened without people out there all over the world marching in front of embassies and doing the kind of things. The Blood Diamonds campaign led to peace in 3 countries in West Africa, and my relationship with Michael somehow helped contribute to him being a pillar now of his community against all odds. People certainly wouldn't have predicted that when he was 13.
Charles in North Carolina asks if you, Michael, had any African-American men who were influential in making the decision to turn your life around.
No.
Just No.
No, it really wasn't, you know, because, you know, my cousins and, you know, my uncles, they, you know, was drug addicts or, you know, drinking heavily. So it wasn't really no role model. But my wife's dad was a good guy, a real good guy.
Your wife's father?
Yes, he was.
Tell me about your wife.
My wife is a wonderful lady. She really, I mean, 100%. Pure woman. She's the boss lady, the real boss lady.
This is Nikki.
Yes, that's my baby. She a real good girl. She basically keep me straight, like right now in the day. I mean, she's smart. You know, she don't take no mess, because we do got five boys. And myself, you know, she keep us in line. You know, she a real good girl, real smart.
And your work. Tell us about your work.
Well, I drive buses now. I drive buses for two companies. I drive a shuttle bus, and I also drive a motor coach bus. And it's a good. I got a passion for driving them buses. I fell in love with the bus when I first learned how to drive the bus. It was amazing. It gave me a feeling the feeling is so awesome, because you behind a big bus. You know what you're doing, and it's. I love it. I love driving that bus.
He took out a loan and took a chance, you know, because if you don't pay that sucker back, it's trouble.
Yeah.
And then he took the course, commercial driver's license course, passed the tests, and then as soon as he passed it and started working, you know, talking to all these different guys who own the companies, man, it immediately snapped him up. So
fantastic. Yeah. Did you ever find yourself missing that life of money and drugs and all the rest?
Yes, yes, I really did. I really did. But I look back on it, you know, it was good while it lasted. But, you know, I'm doing better things now with my life, with my wife, five boys, and my dog. You know,
so. And your dog. Yeah, what kind of a dog do you have?
I got a little white Bichon. Her name.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Her name's Sugar.
Here we go to Susan, who's in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Good morning to you.
Good morning. And I just want to commend both of you for participating in this relationship. I have an eerily similar experience here in Washington, D.C., mentoring a little girl when I was 22, and now have known her 22 years and watched her graduate from college and have a successful career. I would just urge your listeners, it's an amazing experience, as these two have relayed, to mentor, and it can be informal, and it really can change. It changed, I think, my life more than the girl I mentored, although I do think it was exactly a similar experience. My parents became involved, and it took a village, and her church helped her. It wasn't just me and my family, but that's what it takes in our local communities. And if you're retired, if you're a recent college graduate, you can really make a difference.
Did you, Susan, have some difficult times with her?
I did, and I was wondering about if, and I think it was, the question was answered, though, by John. This little girl, her mother was schizophrenic, and it was hard to watch, and it was hard for me to know what to do, whether to involve social services, and I eventually didn't, because I worried so much. I'd read the publicity about how the social services were struggling here. So there were some life lessons that were hard for me to learn, but through all of it, it's the first time I realized I could be a mother, watching this little girl walk away into that house where there were drug dealers outside. And I didn't know how to protect her, but that I'll never forget that feeling I had that I can be a mother. I mean, I love her. I want to protect her. And I did everything I could short of involving social services.
Yeah.
The analogous situation in our lives, Susan, was that 1984, I think, 85, probably somewhere in there, similarly looking at, you know, the social services in D.C. and what a mess it was. And they were thinking about, at least one of the social workers told me they were thinking about taking the kids away. You know, they are living in these homeless shelters, and it was very, very difficult. So I said, I went to Michael's mom, and I said, why don't I take Michael, Sabrina, and James, the three oldest kids in the family, I'll take them up to Philly for the summer, and they can live with me in my apartment, and then you can focus on the smaller kids and sort of pull yourself together, and hopefully these guys will get off our backs here. And they did. They came and lived with me in the summer in Philly, down in South Philly, and it was an extraordinary experience. I learned that I in fact, could be, just as you say, I could be somewhat of a parent. You know, I had it, and it
How
definitely took.
Deal with
oh, it was crazy. I would bring them to work. I had all my buddies were coming from different places, and they were helping me take care of them. I mean, everybody was involved. It was really a remarkable thing. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody just pitched in and said, "Okay, look at John. He's drowning. He's underwater. We better go help him and pull those kids out before he takes them all down."
Do you remember that summer, Michael?
Yeah, I do. I really do. I remember that summer we went to Philly and lived for the whole summer. We enjoyed because we had different people watching us every day. And we had fun. We really did.
And your mother was able to get herself
yes.
back on her feet.
Yes.
That's great. Yep. All right, to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Brenda.
Good morning, Diane. And I'm so glad to be on your show. I'm enjoying listening to your two guests. I have a question for John.
Sure.
John is the guy whose father was, it sounded like early on, he talked about his dad was abusive and wasn't a good father to him. And I guess, I don't know if he had siblings. But when you brought these other children in, you made it sound like he changed. What was your relationship with him then?
You know, I think that he just really could handle younger kids better, and the kids that don't talk back, that are just, you know, you get this, it's almost like a laboratory where you can just try anything and do all kinds of fun stuff. And he was just such a magician with young kids in terms of creativity and thinking of stuff to do. And it was old when kids would get older and start to say no or have different advice, that's when we'd have problems. But I think, you know, that was just great because he just, and his father was described to me similarly by my dad's siblings as somebody who everybody looked up to and everybody loved.
John Prendergast and Michael Mattox, their book, Unlikely Brothers, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Malta, Ohio. Good morning, David.
I want to make a comment. You were referred often to the black-white situation. I'm a person of color, and in the 60s, 70s, I recruited and trained volunteers to work with men and women in prison, supervised 110 of male matches. And what I found, I don't think it's so much a problem today, is that people don't identify so much across color lines with the hurts and the pains. And I had quite a few white volunteers match with black. Also did it for juvenile probation. But today I think there's less of a problem because of growing up in the school situation.
Mm. Do you agree with that, John?
Yeah, I think, I mean, we never thought about color too much, and
no.
and I just think it's becoming, in many ways, less and less of an issue.
All right, now, last question, Michael. John is about to be married. What advice do you have for him? You've been married for 11 years.
Advice I got for John is, it's like honesty. You got to keep it spiced up. Keep it communicating. Everything is 50-50, you know, and, you know, take your wife out, you know, take her to dinner, do special things for her. You know, I think one of the things my wife did love that I did for her was that bubble bath with them candles and them roses with a bottle of champagne. I mean, my wife had a smile on her face that was so unbelievable. And once I did that for her, she called everybody and told them what I did for her. And she loved that.
How many times did you do that?
I did that for her probably about 5 times.
Good for
you. She loved it.
That's pretty good advice,
John.
I got my marching orders.
You got your marching orders. John Prendergast, I want to wish you all success on that marriage.
Thank you.
I hope everything is wonderful. You're being married at Mia Farrow's house.
Yeah, we've been longtime allies and friends, dear, and almost soulmates. And so it's just an honor to be able to go
to her. How wonderful. John Prendergast, Michael Mattox. The book is titled Unlikely Brothers, Our Story of Adventure, Loss, and Redemption. Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much.
And congratulations. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.